Hi guys, just to let you know, I have a promo of another podcast that I would love for you to listen to playing at the end of this episode, so please stay tuned until then.
It seemed inconceivable, didn't it, that a children's nurse could be one of Britain's worst serial killers.
But that's absolutely the key. A nurse is supposed to take care of you, to look after you. That such a person in such a position could do that. She was so combative. She was so sure of herself. She didn't evince any kind of doubts about her position. And it's a great credit to Detective Stuart Clifton, who actually, you know, saw that something was going on. But, you know, the whole thing, you go to Grantham, and even now, 25 years after, and the whole place is still immersed in this incident at the children's hospital there. It's, quite amazing.
Hi, M&Ms. Welcome back to another episode of Murder & More. As always, I am your host, Kira. When we take a person into hospital, or a loved one is admitted to the hospital, whether it be a grandparent, parent, friend, or child, we are under the belief that they are in safe hands. We trust these strangers, who have spent years in training, with the lives of our loved ones. We have no reason not to trust these people. They are employed on the basis that they are kind, caring, loving, that they will treat our loved ones like their own. Never do we stop to think that maybe the people we hold closest to our hearts are in more danger in hospital than they would be by staying at home. Beverly Allett was born on the 4th of October 1968 to Richard, a shop assistant at an off-licence, and her mother was a school cleaner. Beverly grew up with her parents, two sisters, and her brother in a village near Grantham, a town that is known as the birthplace of Margaret Thatcher, that can be found in Lincolnshire, 22 miles east of Nottingham. Beverly tried and failed to get into a grammar school, so instead went to her local high school before taking a nursing course at Grantham College when she was 16 in 1984. Beverly displayed alarming behaviour from a young age, behaviour that is typical of Munchausen syndrome. Munchausen syndrome is a psychological condition where an individual feigns an illness or injury to gain attention. The individual will either pretend to be suffering certain symptoms of a condition or will deliberately cause these symptoms to occur. People with the condition will behave in several different ways. They may feign psychological issues by telling people they can hear voices. They may pretend to have physical illnesses by claiming to have physical symptoms, such as stomach pain, or they would deliberately make themselves ill, for example, rubbing dirt into a wound to make it infected. People with Munchausen syndrome are very manipulative and will likely jump from doctor to doctor, as when they feel one doctor is becoming aware that they are seeking attention and aren't actually sick, they will move on to another hospital so that they can continue the charade. Munchausen syndrome can be caused by several different factors, such as emotional trauma in the person's childhood, or a personality disorder, such as narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, or antisocial personality disorder. Behaviours exhibited by Beverly during her adolescence includes wearing bandages and casts over injuries that she wouldn't permit anyone to examine. Beverly's attention seeking only worsened as she got older, becoming overweight in her teenage years and becoming aggressive towards other people. Beverly spent a lot of time in hospital for a load of different illnesses that probably never existed, and even had her perfectly healthy appendix removed. The scar from the appendectomy took a while to heal due to Beverly's insistence on interfering with it. Beverly was also known to self-harm. When she realised that her behaviour was no longer gaining the attention she craved and needed, she went on to harm others in order to be noticed. This is known as Munchausen's by proxy. Fabricated or induced illness, much more commonly known as Munchausen's by proxy, is a form of child abuse where an individual will feign symptoms and illnesses in another person under their care, usually a child, to gain attention from not just family and friends, but medical professionals. Munchausen's by proxy is usually presented by the child's biological mother, who may exaggerate their symptoms, attempt to persuade a doctor that their child is ill even though they may be perfectly healthy, manipulate test results to prove their child is ill, or deliberately induce symptoms in their child. In around 85% of reported cases of Munchausen's by proxy, the abuse is at the hands of the child's mother. However, there have been cases where the child's father, foster parent, grandparent, guardian, and even healthcare professional, such as Beverly Allitt, is the one responsible for the abuse. No one fully understands the cause of Munchausen's by proxy, but it's thought that the mother may enjoy the attention, may have a personality disorder, may have emotional trauma in their past, or have unresolved psychological or behavioural problems. Some mothers responsible for the abuse may suffer with drug or alcohol abuse and may even have Munchausen syndrome themselves. If you suspect that a child you know is being abused, either by Munchausen's by proxy or any other form of abuse, such as emotional, physical, sexual, or psychological abuse, please do not attempt to confront the person you think is abusing them. Instead, please contact your local social services department or the NSPCC's Child Protection Helpline, which is open 24/7 on 0808 800 5000. During Beverly's training as a nurse, she was suspected of some rather odd behaviour, such as smearing faeces on the walls of nursing homes where she trained. Beverly was also absent a lot from her training due to her long string of fabricated illnesses. Beverly had a boyfriend at the time of her nurse training, who would later go on to describe her as being manipulative, aggressive, and deceptive, and stated that Beverly falsely claimed she was pregnant, and even falsely claimed that he had raped her. Even though Beverly very rarely attended her nurse training and failed her nursing exams, she was still taken on as a staff nurse at Grantham and Kesteven Hospital in Lincolnshire in 1991. The hospital was chronically understaffed, and it's believed that this is the only reason they considered taking on Beverly. Hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I'm sure if they knew then what they know now, they wouldn't have touched Beverly with a 10-foot barge pole. Beverly worked on the children's ward at the hospital, which only had two trained nurses on the day shift, and only one at night, which is why her behaviour went undetected for so long. According to the Nurses Times, the nurse-to-patient ratio should be 1-8. However, working in a hospital myself, I know it's very rare that this is achieved. I occasionally work on a 36-bedded ward, and there are times when we only have 3 registered nurses working, making the ratio 1-12, which is extremely unsafe. On the 21st of February 1991, not long after Beverly began working at the hospital, 7-month-old Liam Taylor was admitted to the children's ward with a chest infection. Beverly strongly reassured Liam's parents that he was in good hands and managed to persuade them to go home and get some rest. He would be okay. Liam's parents agreed, but when they returned later, they heard from Beverly that Liam had suffered a respiratory emergency but had survived and recovered from it well. That night, Beverly volunteered to stay and watch over Liam whilst his parents stayed at his bedside. Just before midnight, Liam had another respiratory emergency but once again fought through it and came out the other side. However, Liam's condition deteriorated once he was left alone with Beverly Allitt and very quickly became deathly pale. Beverly promptly called for the resuscitation team, but her colleagues were confused over the lack of alarm monitors which hadn't sounded when the 7-month-old stopped breathing. Liam quickly went into cardiac arrest, and the resuscitation team did all they could to save the boy, but sadly, due to the lack of oxygen, Liam suffered severe brain damage, and life support machines were the only thing keeping him alive. Heartbreakingly, Liam's parents had to make the awful decision to have their baby's life support machine turned off, and the cause of death was recorded as heart failure. Little did anyone know that this was just the start of a nightmare, that wasn't even close to being over. Just 2 weeks later, 11-year-old Timothy Hardwick was admitted to the children's ward on the 5th of March after suffering an epileptic fit. Timothy had cerebral palsy, which made him all the more vulnerable and also made him prone to having seizures, with over half of people who have cerebral palsy also have epilepsy, as both are neurological disorders. Once again, Beverly took over Timothy's care, and after a period of him being left alone in her care, Timothy went into cardiac arrest. Upon arrival, after Beverly's summons, the resuscitation team found Timothy to be blue and have no pulse. The team involved a paediatrician, and despite their best efforts, they were unable to save Timothy Hardwick. An autopsy failed to determine a cause of death, however, epilepsy was suggested to be the cause. Once again, Beverly wasn't questioned in Timothy's death, and perhaps if she had have been, she wouldn't have been able to continue her reign of terror. But sadly, events didn't fold out that way. Kaylee Desmond was only a year old when she was admitted to the children's ward on the 3rd of March 1991 with a chest infection. Kaylee seemed to be getting over it until she suddenly went into cardiac arrest, eerily in the same bed that Liam Taylor had passed away in just weeks earlier. Thankfully, however, Kaylee didn't meet the same fate as Liam, and the resuscitation team were able to revive her. Kaylee was transferred to a hospital in Nottingham, where she underwent a full examination, and what the doctors found was baffling. Under Kaylee's armpit, doctors in Nottingham found an odd puncture hole and went on to find an air bubble near it. However, doctors just put this down to accidental injection, and once again this case wasn't investigated. It's heartbreaking because there were so many chances to stop Beverly in her tracks and prevent her from hurting any other children, but health professionals didn't appear to be on the ball and recognise the need for an investigation. If an investigation had been undertaken immediately after Liam Taylor's premature death, Timothy Hardwick would never have died and Kaylee Desmond would never have gone into cardiac arrest at just a year old. I'm sure you all want this case to be over, so do I, but sadly it's not. Sadly, several more children had to suffer at the hands of Beverly Owlett before she could be stopped. Paul Crampton was only 5 months old when he was admitted to the ward on the 20th of March with a bronchial infection.
The doctor had asked for him to admit him to the hospital just to keep an eye on him, really. And I think they described him at the time as a happy wheezer. So he clearly had a chest infection. And whilst we were concerned that he was in hospital, we weren't really worried. It seemed to us quite precautionary. He seemed quite happy. And clearly that was the right place to ensure that this chest infection didn't become any more serious.
Paul was recovering well from his infection and doctors were planning on sending him home. However, his parents requested Paul stay another day for observations. However, it would prove to be a hugely fatal mistake. Beverly Owlett was left alone with the boy that night and had to call for help as Paul had collapsed.
Call. Paul had collapsed. Can you please come?
Paul was laid there. Beverly Owlett was certainly in the room. Paul was grey, clammy.
So I came dashing in. The crash team was already there. I checked some blood. I thought he very likely had a low sugar, what we call hypoglycemia.
Dr. Nanya Kara gave him glucose and Paul survived. However, every time he recovered from his attacks, the five-month-old relapsed and went into a near coma on three separate occasions. But doctors were confused. What was causing the fluctuation in Paul's insulin levels? As with Kaylee, Paul was transferred to a hospital in Nottingham, with Beverly travelling with him in the ambulance. He was once again found to have too much insulin in his body, but luckily, Paul Crampton managed to survive all of Beverly's attempts on his life. Just the following day, Beverly Owlett struck again. This time, 5-year-old Bradley Gibson was her target. He'd been admitted with a bad cough, and it was eventually discovered that he had pneumonia. At 3 a.m. one night, Bradley complained to Beverly that his IV, or intravenous drip, was hurting him. Whilst Beverly was attending to the child, Bradley went into cardiac arrest. The resuscitation team worked tirelessly for 32 minutes and thankfully were able to revive him.
Dr. Porter applied electric shock. Not once, not twice, 7-8 times, if not more. And eventually, he just managed to get the heartbeat going.
Blood tests later revealed that Bradley's insulin levels were way too high. Later that night, under the sole care of Beverly Allitt, Bradley suffered another cardiac arrest and was transferred to a hospital in Nottingham. Luckily, Bradley survived Beverly's brutal attempts on his life. However, he didn't come out of the ordeal completely unscathed.
I lost the use of my legs, so I wasn't able to get out of bed, wasn't able to move around. I couldn't control my bladder for a number of years afterwards.
Do you think you suffered mentally?
I had nightmares. I remember waking up quite a number of nights just screaming.
If I'm honest, I'm not sure Beverly was going to cease her reign of terror until she was caught. The day after Beverly very nearly killed Bradley, 2-year-old Yik Hung Chan went into considerable respiratory distress and began turning blue when Beverly raised the alarm. Luckily, the 2-year-old recovered well with oxygen, but was later transferred to the hospital in Nottingham after another attack happened later that day. This time, the respiratory distress was put down to a fractured skull, the result of a fall. Twins Katie and Becky Phillips were born prematurely, so were being kept in the hospital for observations. When the twins were 2 months old, Becky caught a bout of gastroenteritis, which saw her admitted to the children's ward on the 1st of April 1991. 2 days after Becky was admitted to the ward, with Beverly looking after her, Beverly raised the alarm, claiming that Becky was cold to the touch and appeared to be hypoglycemic. But when Beverly's colleagues attended to the alarm, nothing could be found to be wrong with the 2-month-old. Becky went home with her mum that evening. However, later at home, she had a seizure and cried out in pain. The doctor attended and suggested that Becky was probably suffering from colic. Becky slept in the bed with her parents that night so that they could keep a close eye on their baby. But sadly, Becky passed away in the middle of the night. An autopsy failed to determine a cause of death. Becky's twin sister Katie was admitted to the children's ward at Grantham Hospital as a precaution, but unfortunately, Beverly still hadn't been caught and was on duty the day Katie was admitted. Not long after she arrived on the ward, Beverly once again called for the help of the resuscitation team as Katie had stopped breathing. This time, the resuscitation team were successful in bringing Katie back. However, 2 days later, Katie went into cardiac arrest once again. The resuscitation team were again successful. However, this event left Katie with collapsed lungs. Just as with the other children, Katie was transferred to Nottingham Hospital, where it was found that she'd suffered 5 broken ribs from the several resuscitation attempts and had also suffered severe brain damage from the lack of oxygen during the 2 cardiac arrests. Ironically, Katie's mother, Sue Phillips, was grateful to Beverly for saving her surviving daughter's life. Due to these 2 cardiac arrests inflicted by Beverly, Katie developed partial paralysis, cerebral palsy, and hearing loss. Finally, the high number of infants suffering cardiac arrests under Beverly's care began garnering attention, and staff at the hospital became increasingly more suspicious of the alarming number of fatalities. Beverly's final victim would be 15-month-old Claire Peck on the 15th of April 1991. Claire had asthma and required a breathing tube. Within minutes of Beverly being alone with her, Claire went into cardiac arrest. Beverly raised the alarm and the resuscitation team were able to revive the toddler, but within minutes, Claire suffered another cardiac arrest, and this time the team were unsuccessful in bringing the girl back. An autopsy revealed that Claire had died as a result of natural causes, but a consultant at the hospital wasn't convinced. Dr. Nanya Kara wrote a letter addressing his concerns regarding the high number of deaths to the hospital's management.
I wrote a letter on the 22nd to hospital management
expressing our serious concerns and anxieties about series of collapses that were going on, and also mentioning about the result which Dr. Porter had found of Paul Crampton's abnormal blood result.
Dr. Nelson Porter was also extremely alarmed by the number of cardiac arrests that had happened on the ward within the 2 months since Beverly started working there, and opened an inquiry into the incidents. Initially, it was theorised that potentially an airborne virus could be the cause of the sudden spike in the number of deaths, but no evidence was discovered to corroborate this theory. 18 days after Claire passed away, a blood test revealed a high level of potassium in her blood, and the police were notified. Hyperkalemia, or high levels of potassium in the blood, is typically caused by kidney disease, a diet that contains high levels of potassium, or certain medications that cause the kidneys to struggle to dispose of the extra potassium. Other causes of hyperkalemia are taking extra potassium in tablet form, Addison's disease, and poorly controlled diabetes. In long-term hyperkalemia, symptoms are relatively mild, including some muscle weakness, numbness, tingling, and nausea. However, a sudden high level of potassium in the blood can cause heart palpitations, shortness of breath, chest pain, and vomiting. A sudden bout of hyperkalemia can be life-threatening if not treated properly. Claire's body was exhumed, and traces of lidocaine were discovered in her system. Lidocaine, also known as lignocaine, is an antiarrhythmic drug that's used to restore an irregular or fast heartbeat back to normal. Lidocaine is commonly used in ventricular tachycardia, and is a second-line treatment in cardiac arrests that have occurred as a result of VT, a condition where the heart suddenly begins beating much faster than it should be. Lidocaine hasn't been proven to be massively successful in cardiac arrests, therefore it's typically only used if amiodarone has been ineffective or is unavailable. Lidocaine works well in ventricular tachycardia because it slows down the contractions of the heart muscles, effectively slowing down the individual's heartbeat. Superintendent Stuart Clifton was put in charge of the investigation into the multiple deaths that had occurred in the space of a few months at the hospital. Immediately, he suspected that these deaths weren't natural. He believed these babies didn't die of natural causes, but that foul play was involved. And when he looked into the deaths further, he found out he was right. In the majority of the children, dangerously high levels of insulin were found in their bloodstream. Now, I think I touched on the dangers of hyperinsulinemia a few weeks ago in the Malcolm Webster case, but just as a reminder, too much insulin in the bloodstream, if left untreated, will lead to hypotension, bradycardia, and eventually a hypoglycemic coma. If the hyperinsulinemia still isn't untreated, the person is likely to die as a result. The investigation moved fairly rapidly after this discovery. Families of the children who had suffered at the hands of Beverly Allitt were interviewed. All of the nursing records and documents were examined, and a security camera was installed on the children's ward. During the inspection of all the nursing records, it was found that there were documents that were missing, specifically the logs that would have documented the time Paul Crampton, Beverly's fourth victim, was on the ward. Investigators identified 25 separate incidents that involved 13 different children, four of whom had passed away, with the only common denominator amongst the incidents being the presence of Beverly Allitt. She had been on shift, scheduled or voluntary, every single time a suspicious incident had occurred on Ward 4 in the few months she was a member of staff there. Police gathered all of this evidence, including the fact that Beverly had reported the key to the insulin fridge as being missing, and concluded that they had enough to arrest her. In November 1991, 9 months after her reign of terror began, Beverly Allitt was charged with 4 counts of murder, 11 counts of attempted murder, and 11 counts of causing grievous bodily harm. When Beverly was interviewed in relation to these charges, she remained calm and denied any involvement in the murders and attempted murders.
She was quite calm, quite confident for somebody who's just been arrested for murder.
It was unusual. If I had been arrested for attempted murder of a child, then I think myself and most people would have a different reaction. She was really laid back, chatty. You know, it was almost as if, come on, Bev, we're going to take you into town for a cup of coffee, really, and rather than, you know, you've just been arrested on the attempted murder of some child.
She insisted that she had simply cared for the victims involved and helped to try and save the children's lives.
No matter how much you don't believe me, and I know you don't, I don't care. I can't bloody lie to you. I'm not going to sit here and lie to you for days on end while I get questioned.
However, when police searched Beverly's house, they found the missing nursing documents. Stuart Clifton recalls the eerie interview with Beverly. Quote, "She's placed into a police cell, and you have to remember that this is a girl that's about 21 years of age, never been in trouble with the police. She gets all of these charges, and she's laughing. She's happy about them." End quote. Former Detective Inspector Neil Jones also commented, saying, quote, "She was an evil, callous, calculating person. She knew what she was doing. These are defenseless children who rely on her, and she's attacking them. She tried to push the blame towards other people who were present." End quote. During the interview, Stuart Clifton informed Beverly that they'd be arresting her for the attempted murder of Paul Crampton. Quote, "This child has been given a deliberate injection of insulin, from which he could have died. I believe you gave it to him. This child has been given 3 injections of insulin. On each occasion, you were alone with him. It's no coincidence, is it?" End quote. Very calmly, Beverly simply replied, quote, "No reply." End quote. Stuart attempted to continue interrogating Beverly, but gave up when she scoffed and was observed to be smirking.
"You smile. Is it funny? Is it light-hearted? Don't you take the interview serious?"
"No,
I don't think it's funny. I'm sure there's 12 sets of parents down. Parents who are prepared to offer you the responsibility to be godmother to their children. Parents of children who murdered.
Have you got any feelings for them at all?"
"No, I can't."
Detective Michelle Billingsley recalls the interview. Quote, "She tried to bamboozle us. We were trying our best to talk about the insulin and the effects it has on the body. But we weren't medically trained, and I think she could easily pick up on this." End quote.
"There was a certain confident attitude about her. I think she thought, which she did, that she knew more than we did, which put her in that better position, which she obviously enjoyed."
Police performed extensive background checks on Beverly, which unveiled a history of unusual behaviour, indicative of a serious personality disorder, and they also concluded that Beverly showed many signs of Munchausen's syndrome and Munchausen's by proxy. Beverly was extensively assessed, but never confessed to any crimes she had committed in her short career as a registered nurse. Whilst in prison, she developed anorexia nervosa, an eating disorder, and serious mental health condition where the individual does everything they can to lose weight, usually by eating as little as they possibly can and by exercising too much. An individual can develop anorexia nervosa as a result of a distorted self-image, believing they are fat even though they aren't, and over time, the person will become increasingly unwell as they begin to starve. Long-term anorexia can lead to serious side effects, such as osteoporosis, a thinning of the bones, problems with fertility, decreased libido, an irregular heartbeat, hypertension, and even heart failure, just to name a few. If untreated, anorexia can lead to death, either as a result of complications or suicide. As a result of this condition, Beverly lost about 70 pounds, which is 5 stone, and it severely delayed her trial. The trial began on the 15th of February 1993 at Nottingham Crown Court. Michelle Billingsley recalls Beverly's actions and behaviour the day the trial started. Quote, "She was kept in custody at Grantham Police Station and taken to court the next morning. I was on duty the next morning and went to the cell because I was going to accompany her to court. I was shocked that someone could do all these things and not feel any remorse whatsoever. But not only was there no remorse, it was the smile, the shrugging of the shoulders. She was leaning forward, looking out of the van to the people that had gathered round the court, as if she was looking forward to appearing there, end quote. The prosecution told the court how Beverly had been present every time an incident on the ward occurred, and how, when she was removed from Ward 4, suddenly the suspicious cardiac arrests and deaths stopped. The jury were also told of the high levels of insulin and potassium found in the children, as well as injection sites that had been linked to Beverly. Beverly was also accused of cutting off children's oxygen supply by either smothering them or tampering with their machines. Professor Roy Meadow, an expert in paediatric medicine, told the jury about Beverly's pattern of unusual behaviour and multiple illnesses that began in childhood, and explained Munchausen's and Munchausen's by proxy. Professor Roy Meadow told the court that in his expert opinion, Beverly Allitt would never be cured and that she would pose a sincere risk and danger to anyone that she came into contact with. The trial lasted 2 months, with Beverly only attending 16 days of that due to illness, and on the 28th of May 1993, Beverly Allitt was found guilty on each charge and was sentenced to 13 life sentences with a minimum tariff of 30 years. Bradley Gibson's mother, Judith, was pleased with the conviction and sentence.
We're very pleased. 13 life sentences is what we hoped for, and that's exactly what we've got. I only hope that she's never released.
This was the harshest sentence ever imposed on a female, but, in the judge's opinion, it was proportional to the amount of pain and suffering Beverly had inflicted on not just her patients, but their families too. Beverly was initially sent to HMP Holloway on the basis that she was not severely mentally ill when she committed the crimes. However, after only a week, she was moved to Rampton Secure Hospital, a unit which houses individuals detained under the Mental Health Act, as she began refusing to eat or drink. Subsequently, Beverly was diagnosed with a psychopathic disorder, and it's since been suggested that before her trial, Beverly told friends that no matter what happened, she wouldn't go to prison, which begs the question, did she feign mental illness to be moved to the hospital? Trevor MacDonald, who presented a documentary on the serial killer, believes so.
Beverly Allitt was first moved from prison to hospital when she showed signs of anorexia while on remand. But our research has uncovered a psychiatric assessment of Beverly Allitt before trial, which judges her fit to plead and raises serious questions about the authenticity of the original symptoms that had her moved. We've had sight of an official report which suggests that Beverly Allitt was faking the anorexia, which had her moved from prison to hospital in the first place. Is this more evidence of her manipulative behaviour?
An ITV film crew gained access to Rampton Hospital and were able to interview Beverly.
It's not too bad.
What's the good thing about it?
We're out, got more freedom in it.
You like it better than where you were before?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I've got more freedom. I'm not locked up all the time.
However, her victims and the families of her victims are outraged that Beverly has not been locked up in prison, as she so rightly deserved to be for her heinous crimes.
I think it's wrong. She should be in a prison for the crimes she committed.
She's a murderer. She's a child murderer. She's been living the life of Riley in there. She should be serving her life sentences in a prison behind bars.
Beverly will not be eligible for parole until 2022, but even then, the parole board will seriously need to take into consideration the risk Beverly, who'll be 54 at the time, poses to the public. Criminologist Professor Elizabeth Yardley says of Beverly Allitt, quote, "Murder did not come out of the blue with her. She felt a pathological entitlement to attention and recognition. She always had to be centre stage. We saw this in her childhood and teen years, when she would feign injury and illness and create a drama and be at the centre of it. This is a woman who has no empathy, no conscience. She does not feel bad when she hurts other people. Vulnerable children were simply a means to an end, and she knew trauma would guarantee an audience. She may not have set out to become a serial killer, but once she experienced the feeling of power that killing gave her, she wasn't going to stop." There is a reluctance to acknowledge someone working in a caring profession would seek to harm their patients, especially if that person is female. We expect women to be society's caregivers and nurturers. We don't like to think that they would deviate from that role to the extent they would harm vulnerable children. She was looking out for herself. She didn't feel guilt, regret, or remorse about harming and killing children. Having listened to the police interview tapes, her confidence, lack of respect, and bravado in front of experienced detectives is absolutely shocking. End quote. Paul Crampton's father, David Crampton, recalls the horrific experience he went through when his child was a victim of Beverly's. Quote, "We both remember her on Ward 4. She didn't stand out in any way, but she was there when Paul suffered his first attack of hypoglycemia because his blood sugar levels were very low." Kath, Paul's mother, recalls her saying, quote, "This child is hypo," end quote. "I have no doubt she is a manipulative person and used this to get herself into Rampton, but I don't want to waste time thinking about it now. The whole affair took a lot out of our family, and we didn't want to spend any more time worrying about how well or not Alit was being treated. The fact that Alit is never far from the headlines means that what happened still comes up, and we discuss it when it does. I don't think it has affected our abilities as parents, and I hope we haven't been overly protective because of what happened." Paul's older sister and brother were offered counselling after the trial. Paul is well and has had no lasting effects from Alit's crimes against him, which makes dealing with the affair much easier than it perhaps is for some of the less fortunate families. End quote. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for Kayleigh Desmond, who suffers severe learning difficulties and anxiety as a result of Beverly's attack on her. Kayleigh has told ITV that almost 30 years after her ordeal, she still checks under her bed. Quote, "I'm looking for Nurse Alit, because I see her when I'm in bed." End quote. Not only does she check under her bed, but Kayleigh, who is still haunted by the attack and regularly suffers flashbacks, checks her drawers.
"What frightens you now?"
"In thinking come back for me."
"You think that the nurse might be coming back for you?"
"Yeah."
"Yes, that will never happen."
"She wouldn't recognise you now, would she? You was just a little baby. And I tell you time and time again, don't I? Now, don't cry."
"Okay,
sorry."
"I'm sorry."
Kayleigh's adopted mum, Sharon, told ITV, quote, "It's very difficult for her to understand, and you could tell her one day, and then, you know, a few days later or a couple of weeks later, the same questions are asked again," end quote. Beverly Alit's crimes and the aftermath and effects she's had and continues to have on her surviving victims are horrifying. No one can begin to imagine the pain the surviving victims and their families, and the families of the babies who weren't as lucky, must feel on a daily basis. I can only imagine how much the horrors they went through in 1991 haunt them every day of their lives, invade their dreams, their only comfort being the fact that Beverly Alit is off the streets, unable to harm anyone else. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a rating and review, and Patreon to consider becoming a patron of Murder & More. To interact with us, you can follow us on Twitter and Tumblr at Murder & More, Instagram at Murder & More Pod, and Facebook at Murder & More Podcast. To view the sources and pictures for this episode, head over to www.murderandmorepodcast.wordpress.com. Have a great week, and I'll see you all next week for another episode.
Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we're the hosts of Eat Crime, a podcast full of delicious mysteries.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Eat Crime and on Facebook, Eat Crime Pod.
Here's a few examples of what you'll hear.
Laurencia and Bambi Bembenak.
Do what now?
And he had like secretly taken that copy. I don't know why.
Well, I know why.
To murder her?
For murder her.
And I was like, I can't imagine a mom naming their kids Dante.
We're not in a satanic cult.
So. Yes, I don't know. Let's make that abundantly clear.
She seems like she... Provocativity? Is that a word?
She provocativity? Which, I mean, what a businessman.
I know. Yeah, that's what I'm
murdered
saying.
People like, and got paid for it.
It's both true that there is a Conjuring 2, and Conjuring 2 is true. Valerie, get out of here.